Welcome to the Terrorism Index conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. I would now like to call over to Danielle Leger. Ms. Leger, you may begin.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, and we apologize if you had any difficulties joining the call. I'm going to turn the call over momentarily to my colleague, Caroline Wadhams. If anyone on the call has any questions afterwards, you can email me at dleger@americanprogress.org, or you can call me at 202-741-6258. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Caroline Wadhams, Senior Policy Analyst here with the Center for American Progress.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. On behalf of the Center for American Progress and Foreign Policy, I want to thank you for joining today's conference call on the Third Terrorism Index. And again, we apologize for the delay in starting this call. On the call, we have Mike Boyer, who's a senior editor from Foreign Policy Magazine, and we're also honored to have two of our survey participants who are preeminent experts in this field, Bruce Hoffman and Fawaz Jerjes. Before I turn it over to them, I want to tell you a little bit about the genesis of the index. About 1 year ago, the Center and Foreign Policy teamed up to create the Terrorism Index, a comprehensive survey of top national security and terrorism experts from across the ideological spectrum. The 108 experts in this survey include people such as former secretaries of state, Lawrence Eagleburger and Madeleine Albright, Jim Woolsey, who was director of the CIA, Anthony Lake, former national security advisor, Slade Gordon, former senator to Washington State and a 9/11 commissioner, and many other experts from the military and intelligence and academic communities. You can find a list of the participants on the Center's website. When Foreign Policy and the Center first started this joint effort, We initially wanted to create a set of metrics to assess our success and failure in the war on terror, modeled on, I'm sure you've seen, other foreign policy indexes such as the Failed States Index or the Globalization Index. One of our inspirations for creating these metrics was a October 2003 memo written by then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, in which he directed top Pentagon officials to find better measurements for assessing progress in the fight against global terrorism. And one of the most important questions he asked was, are we capturing, killing, or deterring and dissuading more terrorists every day than the madrasas and radical clerics are recruiting, training, and deploying against us? What we discovered, though, when we went about trying to create these metrics was that it was almost impossible to find quantitative data for such a nebulous war on terror. And if data did exist, it was often classified. Thus, we set out to answer these sorts of questions by turning to the professionals who had the most knowledge about terrorism and national security issues. Thus was born the Terrorism Index. This is the third iteration of the survey, and we've moved beyond asking just questions about the war on terror to broader national security questions. To understand how the war on terror fits within a larger U.S. national security framework. We increasingly have tried to ask the experts what we believe the American public wants to know. Who's the enemy? What are we up against? What do they want? What do the experts think we should do about some of the most crucial foreign policy issues of our time, like Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, or, of course, Iraq, which is on everybody's mind? Of course, it's difficult to get policy recommendations in a survey format from our experts, but we've often surveyed them on policy recommendations that have been put out there and tried to get their assessments. I'm going to turn it over to Mike, but let me just quickly introduce Bruce Hoffman and Fawaz Jerjes. Their bios are in the email that was sent to you, but very quickly, Fawaz Jerjes holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Arab and Muslim Politics at Sarah Lawrence in New York. He's the author of two highly acclaimed books on terrorism, Journey of the Jihadist Inside Muslim Militancy and the Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. He's currently a Carnegie Scholar, and he just returned from the Middle East, where he conducted hundreds of interviews of civil society leaders, opinion makers, activists, and militant Islamists in the Muslim world and within Muslim communities in Europe, and he's working on two books. Professor Bruce Hoffman has been studying terrorism and insurgency for 30 years. He's currently a tenured professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service in Washington. He previously held the corporate chair in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency at RAND. Let me now turn it over to Mike Boyer from Foreign Policy. Thanks.
Thanks, Caroline. I'll just very quickly summarize some of the results that came out of the index that represent the views of the group of experts as a whole, and then we'll turn it over to Fawaz and Bruce for their individual opinions. When we look at the index's results, the results of the Third Terrorism Index, what we see is that the last 6 months may have been the most defining time in the war on terror since 9/11. 91% of the index's experts in near unanimous agreement now say that the world is growing more dangerous for Americans in the United States. That's the highest percentage of experts at any point since we launched the index a year ago, and it's an increase of 10 percentage points from just 6 months ago. 84% of the experts say that we're losing the war on terror, and 83% continue to expect an attack on the scale of 9/11 sometime in the next decade. The main reason for this pessimism appears to be events on the ground in Iraq. 53% of the experts say that the surge of troops into Baghdad is having a negative impact on the war effort, an increase of 22 percentage points from just 6 months ago. This sentiment was shared across party lines. Nearly two-thirds of those experts who identified themselves as conservatives said the surge is having a negative impact or no impact at all. 7 in 10 of the experts now favor drawing down and redeploying U.S. forces out of Iraq. And while most do not favor an immediate withdrawal, the situation in Iraq appears to have deteriorated to the point where 1 in 5 experts now favor an immediate withdrawal, including 25% of those experts identifying themselves as conservative. The belief that we need to get out of Iraq may stem at least in part from the fact that when the White House says that such a move will encourage the enemy to follow us home, the experts don't necessarily agree with that. Just 12% of the experts say that attacks will occur in the United States as a direct result of U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq, while 88% say that such a scenario is either unlikely or they see no correlation between a troop withdrawal from Iraq and terrorist attacks here at home. Whatever the policy course we take in Iraq, many of the experts seem to believe that any effort is too little, too late. When we ask them about the outcomes of the war in Iraq in 10 years' time, 58% of the experts said that Sunni-Shia tensions in the Middle East will have increased. 47% said that Iran will have emerged as the most powerful force in the region. 35% said that Arab dictators will have been discouraged from reforming. 32% said that Al-Qaeda will have been strengthened, while just 3% said that Iraq would be a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And interestingly, for the first time in any of the indexes, what we found in this index is that the effort in Iraq now appears to be informing the way the foreign policy community in the United States thinks about broader challenges in the next fronts in the war on terror. When we asked them about Iran, for instance, 83% of the experts said that they do not believe Tehran when it says its nuclear program is for civilian purposes. But just 8% favor taking military action in response, while 80% said that they favor a strategy of containment and bilateral dialogue. So I think, as Caroline said, we're beginning to use the index to help develop a picture of not just a scorecard of how are we doing, are we winning the war on terror, but where should we go next, what policies should be conducted in response. I'll turn it over to Fawaz. I think you wanted to go first, and we'll just get your brief reaction to the results of the index, and then Bruce, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mike. I have spent about 15 months in the region, and what I have been trying to do is to try to understand what's happening within Islamist militancy, within the social phenomenon of Islamist militancy, look at it from within. And I don't think I'm saying anything original if I say that it's constantly changing and shifting and mutating as well. And I think alarming as it is, the survey does not really highlight the gravity of what I call the crisis that's unfolding in the Middle East and the larger Muslim world. And I think the reason why this crisis is very critical, because I think it might have some serious ramifications for American foreign policy and the pro-American Arab regimes and Muslim regimes in particular. And I think, again, the entire region appears to be boiling, not just in Iraq and Palestinian territories, but in Lebanon, in Syria, in Egypt, in North Africa. And I think this particular crisis, even though Islamist militancy lies at the heart of this particular crisis, it is a broader and greater crisis that has to do with the crisis of what I call the post-colonial Arab state. I mean, you have failed states, failed economies, failed institutions. And I think Islamist militancy that has been mutating and shifting in the last 15 years or so is a direct product of the crisis of the post-colonial Arab states. But let me just make five or six points, which are basically directly related to the survey. I think the first point I would like to make is that while in the United States we tend to focus a great deal on the Al-Qaeda central, what I find, or one of my findings, is that it's Al-Qaeda ideology rather than Al-Qaeda central that's spreading and migrating into several Muslim communities in the larger Middle East and tiny Muslim communities in Europe. And I think what alarms me the most is that it seems to me the Al-Qaeda ideological claims, the big claims, that the United States is waging a war, a crusade against Arabs and Muslims, are finding receptive ears, not only among Islamists, but also mainstream Muslims. I'm truly very alarmed when I talk to intelligent Arabs and Muslims about, the suicide bombings, the insidious deadly bombings in Iraq. And the answers I receive is that it's not Al-Qaeda that's carrying out those lethal attacks against Iraqis. It's rather the American intelligence services and the Mossad. And this tells me, going beyond the conspiracy theories, is that somehow Al-Qaeda's claims, big claims, are now at least finding receptive ears in that part of the world. And I think the challenge is to counter those insidious ideological claims, to try to diffuse this particular ideological narrative, and also try to put out the fires that's really spreading from Iraq into Lebanon, into the Gulf and other areas as well. The second point I would like to make is that militancy, and in particular in the last 10 years or so, appears to be spreading into the poverty belts of Arab and Muslim cities. It's no longer, jihadism or militant Islamism. I don't find it any longer an elitist, aristocratic phenomenon as it used to be in the 1970s and 1990s. Now it's spreading into those huge poverty belts in Egyptian cities, in Yemen, in Morocco, in Algeria, in the Palestinian refugee camps, in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon. And I think in this particular sense, there are plenty of recruits and potential recruits who are basically willing to rise up and take arms against their real or imagined enemies in that part of the world and against the United States as well. The third point I would like to make is that, again, to come back to the Al-Qaeda central and the Al-Qaeda-centric approach, which is, it's real, it exists. We cannot afford to ignore it. But I don't think it really captures the complexity of the Islamist phenomenon in the region today. Again, in the last 15 months, I interviewed hundreds of Muslim teenagers who have nothing to do with either Al-Qaeda or jihadism. And most of them tell me that they are trying to raise a few hundred dollars to take either a bus ride or a flight to the Syrian-Iraqi border and join the fight against the Americans and the coalition forces. And I think this is a serious phenomenon. And it seems to me the Iraq war here, and this is my fourth point, is that it's not only providing motivation and ideological ammunition to the Al-Qaeda central, It's also fueling local insurgencies and enabling radicals to mobilize and recruit young men from various backgrounds in order to take arms against their own governments and Western targets, in particular the United States. And what I also found in my interviews, and I'm very struck by this, and this is my fifth point, how confident radicals and militants appear to be. It seems to me the consensus among former jihadis and radical militants is that they are winning the war against the United States and that the United States is going under. And I think it's very critical, I would argue, to zero in on this particular psychological factor, that the question is that militants, the resistant forces, Al-Qaeda, are winning the war, because it seems it might help us to understand why more and more young men and why and more radical militants as jihadis are taking arms against the United States and basically trying to contribute to this particular victory. And in fact, I don't need to tell you that the most popular slogans in the region today is that al-mumana'a and al-muqawama, defiance of America and resistance. Really, those two particular slogans, again, resonate widely in that part of the world. And I think I want to conclude because I think the challenge facing the United States, I would argue, is to find ways and means to extract its forces from Iraq while finding ways and means to fill the vacuum, the security vacuum. Because I think I would argue that the United States cannot afford to pack and leave Iraq overnight. Because already Al-Qaeda is saying that they have broken the backbone of the United States. And if Iraq descends into chaos and all-out war, I would argue that Iraq could be a major nightmare for the region and for American security interests. And I would argue that the Al-Qaeda, the model in Iraq to fight Al-Qaeda, to work with local communities, is worth giving it really a second chance. And let me conclude by saying that I would argue winning hearts and minds is really has become more of a cliche. I don't think we are at a particular now point where we can really aim to win hearts and minds. I think our challenge and our task is to basically counterbalance the Al-Qaeda ideological claims, to try to defuse the time bombs that are spreading from Iraq into other areas, and also try to put out the fires that are spreading from Iraq to Lebanon, to Palestine, to Jordan, and Palestinian refugee camps. I want to stop here and give Bruce a few minutes to make further points.
Okay, thank you very much. Like Fawaz, I can't disagree both reading the survey and even from my own experiences. I just returned from a month spent in Southeast Asia, including in the southern Philippines. And I would say if you wanted to take a bumper sticker from both my experience, I think, as is reflected in Fawaz's in the Middle East and then from this poll, is that where we've really been particularly either remiss or ineffectual is in fighting the Al-Qaeda brand as hard as we've fought the actual Al-Qaeda terrorists. Looking at this poll, it's hard to see how it doesn't present, you know, an enormously bleak and melancholy picture of where we are in the war on terrorism. And it's difficult not to read it as a repudiation, really, of the entire current conduct of the war on terrorism. There were, I don't want to go over some of the highlights that Caroline and Mike had already talked about, but there were three things that they hadn't mentioned that, or mentioned perhaps only briefly, in addition to what they said that leapt out at me. First was the index article begins with the observation that 6 in 10 Americans believe that no new attack is imminent. Yet I found it extraordinary that more than 80% of the experts polled believed with some degree of certainty that there would be an attack against the United States along the lines of 9/11 within the next decade. So the argument that we're safer today than we were before 9/11 is really cast, I think, in considerable doubt by the experts' view. Secondly, picking up on something that Fawaz had said and also Mike, what I thought was especially interesting about the poll is that the experts seem to argue for a far greater degree of granularity and of nuance in our approach to countering terrorism, especially, I think, with respect to the use of, you know, quote-unquote, soft power, in that, you know, whether, and I think Fawaz is right that hearts and minds is probably at this stage an overreach, but certainly countering and watering down al-Qaeda's brand has to remain one of our key priorities. And I think that comes across, the importance and the salience of that, and the missing element in our current approach comes across with the response that, you know, more than 30% of those polled thought the most important policy option for the United States was this exercise, let's say, of more soft power, whether it's hearts or minds, but whatever. And the fact that it was up 29% from January, from just this past January, I think that's quite extraordinary. Similarly, I thought it was very interesting as part of this use of soft power that a majority favored some form of engagement with Hezbollah and Hamas. Once again, I think, pulling away from the principle established at the beginning of the war on terrorism that almost is a one-size-fits-all, that, you know, all terrorist groups were the same and were equally needed to be treated equally. But finally, I found the thing that was most extraordinary in the poll, which is an important point but hasn't received any discussion in it yet, is attitudes towards Pakistan. And here, I think that the Bush administration, even into its second term, looks back over the past 6 years and sees, I think indisputably, that one of its major foreign policy achievements, and perhaps the one that they believe will be the most lasting, was the key activities and negotiations that brought President Musharraf into the fold on the war on terrorism and secured Pakistan's cooperation 6 years ago, and also that safeguarded Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. I mean, this is still, I think, believed to have been the one thing that, despite the setbacks with al-Qaeda now being on the march rather than on the run, despite the disappointments in both Iraq and Afghanistan, this is the one thing that I think the administration believes has been, you know, its most solid achievement. Yet, you know, 35% of the experts polled put Pakistan as the most likely next al-Qaeda stronghold, leading the list. Nearly three-quarters thought that Pakistan was the most likely to transfer nuclear weapons to jihadis and to terrorists, which is, I think, singularly disturbing, given that this is one of our closest allies. And also, too, that that more than half concluded that Pakistan had an overwhelming negative effect on U.S. National security. You sort of combine that with the other observation that al-Qaeda and the jihadis today pose the single greatest threat to our national security, which was up to 32% from 22% in January. And you see that we live in a far more dangerous world, it seems, than we have at any time since 9/11. So I'll stop there.
Great. At this time, we'd like to open it up for some questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you'll be placed into the queue in the order received. If your question is answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press pound. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. Our first question comes from Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. Please state your question.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I wanted to follow up on the Pakistan comments, because I was struck by, while there, as Bruce Hoffman pointed out, is a considerable amount of concern about Pakistan, there was a considerable lack of consensus as to what to do about it. And I was curious whether there was any discussion about that among the participants, or whether y'all were also struck by the seeming lack of good policies, options for the U.S. in Pakistan.
Bruce, do you want to take that?
Well, I mean, you know, this was precisely the difficulties that the administration hoped to avoid by forging this close alliance and relationship with Pakistan that, you know, obviously, you know, hasn't worked, in the sense that it may well have imprisoned us in not being able to take actions that we might take against other countries because of the fragility both of Musharraf's government and a non-jihadi regime, and overturning that, perhaps giving the jihadi a victory, or the risk of the nuclear arsenal being out of control. I mean, I think that's exactly the point. There aren't many good options.
Fawaz, do you have anything to add?
No, nothing.
I think we also...
I can't add anything either, I don't think.
I would just say that, this is Caroline from the center, we were also struck by the fact that everyone seemed to be pointing to how dire the situation was with Pakistan, and that there seemed to, the experts seemed to be pointing to a need for a policy change, but the experts were all over the map about what we do about it. And I think that just highlights the dilemma that U.S. policymakers are facing. We didn't have follow-up conversations with the participants on this question, but it's something that we definitely want to explore in future surveys.
Let's take the next question.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. At this time, we have no further questions.
All right.
Okay, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And again, if you have any further questions, please feel free to call me. This is Daniela Gibbs-Leger at 202-741-6258.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.